Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Camilia Conn about her book, Mental Capacity and Relationship, Decision-Making, Dialogue and Autonomy. It was published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. I'm actually really lucky and pleased to speak to Camilia because it's the second time I've had the chance to speak to her. So you can also listen to the other interview, which is also on our website, about her other book that she co-wrote with Alex Rux Keane. Just to tell you a little bit about Dr. Camilia Conn, she's a senior research fellow at the Institute for Crime and Justice Policy Research at Birkbeck at the University of London. She's the principal investigator of the project Judging Values and Participation in Mental Capacity Law. Camilia is a moral and political philosopher with research expertise on medico-legal conceptualization of mental capacity, the ethics of psychiatry and psychiatric genomics, and the hermeneutics and phenomenology of mental disorder. Camilia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Jane.
It's a pleasure. The pleasure's all mine, really. So just to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write Mental Capacity and Relationship?
So as you mentioned, my background is in moral and political philosophy, and my PhD thesis really looked at theories of practical reasoning in the tradition of moral philosophy. And once I finished my thesis, I was really interested in just kind of continuing this long-standing interest in how we conceptualize reasoning, how we conceptualize agency. And so I was a very lucky recipient of the British Academy postdoctoral fellowship to write this book. And it was just really to try to extend my interest in this area of practical reasoning and agency to, kind of medical juridical issues. I'm particularly interested in how we understand those contrast cases in the philosophical tradition, those cases which are considered non-ideal. We tend to think about rationality and practical reasoning and agency in these ideal terms. And so people with impairments of some kind, with disabilities, are always seen as falling outside this circle of these ideal conditions. And so I think one of the things that has emerged and this book has tapped into is this kind of longstanding interest in how we can have a more inclusive philosophical account, which means that, you know, individuals with different forms of coping, different forms of knowing the world and engaging with the world are not seen as somehow outliers of our what is, you know, what we might consider to be worthy of respect, worthy of validation, worthy of understanding. And so that's sort of how the book really emerged.
And I actually really love that about the book, because you do tackle all of these really difficult and complex issues that are sort of, you know, like in law and legislation, both domestically and then also in respect of, say, for example, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. You know, the sort of more obvious cases, I think, are more easily solvable, but it's these really difficult cases that there isn't a simple solution and, you know, the laws don't really seem to fit. So I really did enjoy that about the book and how you applied both philosophy and law to some very real feeling cases. Now, I want to just go to where you open the book about problems with mental capacity. And so that's the title of the first chapter. And so in this part, mental capacity is contextualized in the universal importance of autonomy, but notwithstanding its significance, you write that the right to decision-making has only been extended to people with impaired mental capacity fairly recently. Now, in this space, you raise this sort of seemingly contradictory tension, and I think this comes back to this idea of hard cases. So on the one hand, the law, and I mean, please correct me if I've misunderstood, but the law places great significance on a person's ability to make decisions based on their mental capacity, even if this means that at times decision-making capacity may require support from others. But at the same time, there's this gap in the recognition of how relationships influence mental capacity and the decision-making process. Now, in providing somewhat of a working framework for the book, can you describe how legal practice pulls in opposite directions in this sense? That is between what you describe as interpersonal source of capacity and also the intrapersonal source of capacity.
So I think that... I think it probably goes back to the UN Convention and also the kind of interplay between the UNCRPD and mental capacity regimes like the one that is in England and Wales. And I think that these tensions arise in both sets of laws, really, or, you know, and the convention and the Mental Capacity Act in England and Wales. So the intrapersonal dimension of capacity really emerges in our kind of functional accounts of capacity, where there's an emphasis on what is your internal process of reasoning? What is your deliberative process and how do you express your reasons to others? And so there's a lot of emphasis on mental capacity and decisional capacity being within one's head. So in that respect, it's kind of an intrapersonal dimension, which is supposedly tracked by the functional test. And where you see the CRPD, they reject this account, and rightly so, because they emphasize about how disability is a construction of society. It's reinforced by kind of the barriers that are created in society and our political structures and our, you know, sociocultural structures, etc., our economic structures. And they also make provisions about how important it is to have supports in the this account. However, there is also a strong emphasis on that intrapersonal autonomy, that person, the individual as the locale of preferences, of the expression of their will. So there's a very strong emphasis on the individual. And what the book is really trying to do is emphasize how capacity is interpersonally situated. It is situated within some kind of a intersubjective dialogue, you know, so the dialogical conditions in which one is placed matter, how one communicates matters. It's really to also displace this emphasis on the individual that is being questioned about their capacity, impaired capacity, or the assertion of their legal capacity, etc., and to really examine what are the conditions, the social conditions, the dialogical conditions that facilitate the competencies in order to make a decision when you have conditions of embodied impairment of some kind.
Yeah, and so then I think that your argument comes through that you're right, that mental capacity must be conceived of as a relational concept that can be enhanced through intersubjective dialogue. Can you explain more what you mean by this?
So I suppose it's very simply stated in some ways that we tend to perceive that reasoning is all within one's head, you know, that I am going to deliberate about what I'm going to have for breakfast, what I'm going to wear, and these are all the, you know, my own preferences, and this is my own process. I go through a process of deliberation that is somehow removed from the social context, removed from my relational conditions. But if you just even think about that preference, about what you wear today, about how that could also be that is situated within certain conditions. So when you're, because I have young children, and I'm just thinking about that, at some point when they will express a preference for wearing some, a wholly inappropriate piece of clothing, I will be a person influencing their decision around what they wear. So this is a very mundane example, but if you think of the even more profound questions about whether one has is make a decision about refusing treatment based on their religious convictions, and they've grown up with certain religious commitments, what we have to always determine, how do those relational conditions and those how do they impact on the formation of one's preferences, the formation of one's values, and the expression of those values through one's decisions.
Yeah, and it makes sense. So I just want to try and sort of sum up a little the overarching arguments in the book. And again, please tell me if I'm way out of line or do correct me. So the first argument, you write that an individual's environment, particularly one's surrounding relationships, affects one's ability to make decisions. And so you sort of touched on this just a moment ago. In this space, you argue that supportive environmental relational features will cultivate autonomy competencies within individuals with impairments, namely a range of socially acquired perceptual, psychological, emotional, and cognitive skills necessary to engage with the world and make choices in accordance with one's values. Conversely, the absence of supportive relationships and environments, or the presence of abuse, manipulation, and coercion, can't fundamentally disable individuals' decisional abilities. Do you want to talk first to this point, and then we can sort of move to the other arguments?
So that argument really is informed by a lot of work in feminist philosophy, for example, because there is an emphasis on looking at the social context and the process of socialization in which one's autonomy competencies are developed. Here I'm heavily influenced by the work of Diana Myers, whom I think wrote a brilliant book about this, about her account of relational autonomy. And it's really to emphasize how we tend to think of autonomy as an achievement, an individual achievement, that one it's sort of manifest in one's assertion of one's will or certain mastery of one's will in some form, right? So that you might have conflicting preferences, for example, but you override them with a more long-standing desire, for example, or you make a decision based on your long-standing values, etc. But it's seen as a kind of individual achievement. And the point about that I'm trying to make in that argument, which is really, as I said, following Diana Myers, is about how we cultivate certain competencies that allow us to make autonomous decisions. And this occurs within context. This occurs in a context where we can be supported, we can be properly provided with the narratives that provide self-esteem and allow us to cultivate an authentic sense of self. But equally, we could be in situations where our relationships are barriers to that, and we actually cultivate an inauthentic self, a self that is fundamentally just a reflection of our relationships, our toxic relationships, for example. And I mean, I think that this is kind of a long-standing interest of mine around the influence of trauma and how this can impact the formation of our desires and our preferences and our values, and to probe that question about, well, is that an authentic self? This self is it, the preferences and desires and values are all egosyntonic, as in consistent with one another, but they reflect very, very toxic narratives or toxic relationships, and they've been internalized, and so those can be real barriers to the expression and the formation of autonomy competencies.
And I think that really leads into the sort of next main argument, where you talk about, in some cases, third-party interventions may actually be justified, for example, in cases of disabling relationships. But you're right that these interventions must be justified and carried out with certain ethical constraints. Do you want to talk more to this point also?
So I don't think that there is it's a free-for-all in terms of the kind of interventions that are permissible. They have to be constrained by a kind of telos or an aspiration towards the promotion of autonomy competencies and enabling the development of those competencies, of being in a situation where one is able to develop those. I think that there was one case I cite in the book, and I can't, for the life of me, can't remember this at this point, but there was a really lovely example of this young man who had a real dependency on his mother, but, you know, he was forced to basically stay in a corner of their homeless shelter, effectively, I think, and he could not move, so he had to urinate and defecate in the same position in all this, and there was a case which was trying to determine whether it was permissible to remove him from these conditions under the MCA, and he at that time had expressed that how much he had wanted just to stay with his mother and how much he had been attached to his mother, But they ended up removing him, and he ended up being in a far better situation where he was able to flourish as a self, you know, flourish as and develop his own independent preferences. He wanted to have a girlfriend. He wanted, and it was just so. It's not just because you're trying to impose your own vision about how their life ought to be in substantive terms, that this person ought to be, you know, X, but in some respects to just enable them the possibilities of developing those competencies, those emotional, psychological, and rational competencies to make decisions for themselves.
That was a really interesting case. I can't remember the name either, but the situation that the man was in was really quite sad. So it did raise some like really interesting sort of tensions. You know, he's expressing one view, but, you know, as you say, he wasn't able to flourish until he was away from that dependent and even arguably abusive relationship. So that was really interesting reading cases like that to show how this tension can play out. And then finally, I mean, and this goes to sort of the ethical constraints. You just said it's not a free-for-all. You write about how capacity assessments themselves are intersubjectively situated, and that the very manner in which these assessments are carried out can have a profound effect on the individual whose capacity is under scrutiny. Capacity adjudications are informed by their particular medico-judicial environment, by their own traditions, preconceptions, and therefore are not value neutral despite their air of objectivity. And then in this context, interpretive skills of capacity adjudicators hinge on the exercise of critical reflexivity within the medico-judicial context, where background values and presuppositions in judgments are explicit and open to scrutiny, even if the outcome of the capacity adjudication overlaps with what we think is morally defensible. Can you talk a little bit about this, about how, you know, these judgments are actually not value neutral? And I do remember from your other book as well, this point really came through, it really struck me. Your book on Mental Capacity Act in 2005.
I think that there is a temptation to treat capacity assessments as a kind of checklist, or there's also a temptation to think about, oh well, I'm assessing a person's capacity, and I'm kind of removed from certain dialogical conditions, and I'm also certain I'm value neutral. And I don't think it's conscious. I think that, but it's a kind of professional standard. And in some of our research with lawyers, we've also seen how much that permeates in the kind of professional culture, that perception, because it's seen as an ideal, for example. And my point here is to really stress how one is always situated in certain presuppositions. Now, here I think that my biggest influence has been the work of Gadamer, Hans-Georg Gadamer, and he writes in Truth and Method about how we are all situated in an interpretive relationship, as it were. You know, so we cannot remove the fact that we have prejudgments or prejudice. And one of the critical points that he makes in that book is how we tend to think of prejudice in quite a pejorative manner. But in fact, prejudice is literally prejudgment. It's what we start from, the position we start from, when we start from somewhere. And I think that my point there is to really stress how one has to acknowledge that you are embedded in prejudice of some kind. And part of the interpretive situation in a capacity assessment is to also be aware and reflect on one's own, where one starts from and what is being evoked in one's engagement with the person who is being assessed.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. It is sort of, you could almost say, a myth of judging in the judicial system that, you know, we are able to be objective and value neutral when, I mean, we're all human and we do start from somewhere, as you say. So I want to turn sort of then to two points that you've touched on already, the sort of internal and external challenges to the concept and the test of mental capacity. So firstly, turning to the internal challenge, you write that legal applications of the functional test often make two philosophical contestable assumptions. Firstly, that autonomy is individualistic rather than relational concept. And also that capricious reasoning is an intrapersonal rather than an interpersonal act, reflective of the individual's own cognitive processes. Both of these assumptions are inattentive to ways in which autonomy and rationality are vulnerable to internal as well as external compulsions. Whereas also you've mentioned already, there's this external challenge that comes from the CRPD. Do you want to talk about both of these points?
So the internal challenge is in some respects highlighting how the functional test and the account of how mental capacity is measured is sort of philosophically incoherent. It is, and what I find a little bit worrying is how legal interpretation of a mental capacity in some ways has reinforced that kind of perception that capacity is in one's head, because there is a strong emphasis in England and Wales, for example, about the causative nexus between the impairment of the mind and the ability to decide. And so the emphasis on that causative nexus, the language is very, very evocative about how there is a kind of causal connection between that impairment of one mind and the ability to decide. And in some respects, it's philosophically problematic, because there is a lot of work that has shown how that account of decision making is kind of reductive and ignores a lot of the relational conditions, important features of our decision making that are just not captured in that account. But it's also problematic from a phenomenological perspective, because it is in some respects not attentive to the phenomenology of impairment and about how one and the embodiment of impairment and coping and understanding and engaging with the world when one has certain impairments of the mind. And if one is to be attentive to that, then you have to move away from a purely cognitive account of capacity. The external challenge comes with, as you mentioned, the CRPD, because, I mean, the CRPD fundamentally, depending on your interpretation of Article 12, fundamentally questions the validity of the notion of mental capacity. And so there are obviously are divergent interpretations of Article 12, but if we take the one that has been highly influential, which is the committee's interpretation of Article 12, the notion that you can have any mental capacity regimes, any account of assessing mental capacity and imposing best interest decision-making that is seen to be fundamentally invalid.
And so this sort of picks up on the point you write later in the book, or also in this section, about how there's this sort of like idea, like this liberal idea. I think that the CIPD committee in its interpretation of Article 12 almost picks up that, you know, this sort of like hands-off approach to autonomy. And, you know, the idea is to sort of offer support but not intervene in any way. There's this emphasis on, you know, individual autonomy. So then in like your argument, how can you contrast these ideas of individual approaches to rights in comparison with the concept of relational rights?
So the account of relational rights, I think, challenges that notion that we can have a very, that we can adhere to the public-private mm-hmm. distinction as a hard and fast rule. Mm-hmm. And I think that the liberal commitment to autonomy and individual rights really has this set in stone in many ways. So if we think about relational rights and work that has been done on relational rights, like Jennifer Nadelsky's work, she emphasizes how, for example, in the context of domestic abuse and rape and you know, kind of crimes against women and violence against women, where in order to track the problematic implications of the public and private distinction, we just need to look at these cases, because in some respects, the public-private distinction falls away if we're thinking about how a liberal commitment to individual rights, there's a sense in which we protect the private sphere, and the domestic sphere is seen as the primary example of the private sphere. But as soon as we are interested in the implications of the law and how it affects women, for example, then we have to question that private-public distinction in set in the law, because the implication is that you know, certain crimes, certain wrongs are not enforceable, are not, you cannot actually account for them. You cannot actually you know, that it's not possible, given the fact that it seemed to be in this sphere of the private, as opposed to what is legitimately within the public sphere and is and is worthy of intervention.
So then I think my next question hints at what you're just sort of saying now. Can you talk then about how a relational analysis of rights can actually promote decisional capacity?
I think that it means that we are more attentive to our place and our role in affecting decisional capacity. I think that the emphasis, as I mentioned in this book, is to focus on how we as a community might affect the decision making of individuals. I think it's a kind of, in that respect, I think it's quite a global argument about how we all are affected by our communities and our relationships. And so if we're thinking about the context of rights and promoting the decisional autonomy of individuals, then we have to think about how what our narratives are, how we are communicating and interpreting certain individuals that are seen to have we seem to have impairments of some kind. We have to be attuned to those, to certain perceptual cues. I think there's just what it means is that there's far more work to be done on our part to promote the autonomy, the decisional autonomy and capacity of other individuals.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. So then sort of applying this theory, maybe we can talk now a little bit about some of the examples that you gave in the book and how you applied this sort of philosophy and how it's just to show how it sort of plays out. So one of the cases you gave was of Anne, a young woman who struggled with anorexia nervosa. And And then there was also Rob, who experienced his first serious schizophrenic episode as a 17-year-old. And he may have been the person in the book who became the subject of the relationship of dependency and helplessness and reliance on his mother. So that was that you mentioned earlier. And then there was also Joan, the older woman who was living in a care home because she had dementia. Now, she seems to undergo almost a major shift in her, perhaps her personality, but certainly also her values and relationships. I remember you wrote about, you know, she was a very, I think, conservative woman who really valued her marriage. But then when she had dementia, she sort of wanted to break out of that mold. So I'm wondering if you can sort of apply some of these arguments in some of these cases a little bit.
So I think, I mean, to go back to the example of Anne, and I think that, that's the example that really interests me. I mean, all of them do, but that one is partly because in this case, I think the way that I set it up is that her, and I think it's also commonly attributed to people with anorexia, is that their reasons are egosyntonic, that their reasoning is very, very consistent. So it fulfills all the conditions in which we might think apply in a functional test of capacity, that she would pass this. And I think Applebaum has written about this as well. But one of the things, one of the features in that case study was about how her family context was highly highly demanding, and there was a certain context where she was consistently told she wasn't good enough. It was, you know, so there are certain toxic narratives that surrounded her and reinforced this sense of, you know, her needing to be thin. I think there was a lot of pressure for her to be in ballet or something. I think I wrote something along those lines. And I think that the way that one would apply my philosophy in that case is to think about the impact and to assess the impact of those narratives. And because on the face of it, her reasoning is purely is consistent, you know, and it's just if we were to think about the functional test in a very simplified form, the stripped back form that, you know, that we can see the MCA, for example, in England and Wales, it would be hard to say that she lacks capacity to refuse treatment. All her reasoning to refuse treatment is aligned with her values. It's aligned with her vision of herself. But I think that with the tools that I'm trying to advocate for, that I argue for in the book, is to suggest that we have to look beyond that, just that discrete mode of deliberation at that point. We have to think about the broader context in which, well, how have her narratives been developed? I mean, you know, what is her sense of self expressing? Is it expressing a kind of authentic vision of herself? Has she even had the opportunity to develop a sense of an authentic self that is premised on certain, I think, substantive conditions? You know, and I talk about the substantive conditions later on in the book about these nurturing relations to the self. And I think that this does not mean in the first instance that you always intervene. You know, I think that there are, but it does mean that the scope of our inquiry is broadened so that we at least try to understand the context in much more detail and think about it as relevant to the assessment itself.
And then this relates to this idea that, that, you know, patient autonomy has become dominant. So you cite Paul Wolf, and you write that patient autonomy has now emerged as the most powerful principle in ethical decision-making in medicine, but that respect for patient autonomy requires specific conditions. So can you talk about maybe the implications on this emphasis on autonomy in decision-making?
I think in the context of the law, I mean, we can see that in the you know, certain interpretations of the of Article 12 and the CRPD, the strong emphasis on will and preferences, the expression of individual will and preferences, and acceding to those will and preferences, regardless of the content. And I think that that is also, you know, evident in some, you know, in some cases where we have a strong emphasis on how what an individual expresses and that kind of being the last word. There's also a problem, and I don't write about it in this book, but I mean, some further work that I have done is looking at the concept of what it means to make a peace-centric decision for an individual in the context of mental capacity law, because there is a strong emphasis on, well, we're going to have our best interest decision making is peace-centric and the proceedings are peace-centric, but there's very little understanding about what that actually means in substantive terms. Often it is just seen as equivalent to, well, we need to adhere to the wishes and feelings, the preferences of the individual, and that's kind of the last word. Yeah. But in some respects, that is a fairly reductive account of what our obligations are to individuals in these circumstances. And peace-centricity really means something far deeper about the kind of moral orientation that we approach in which we approach an individual. It reflects the interpretive situation, how we interpret and understand individuals. Are we, you know, so I think that there's far more that is required. And the problem with, you know, this adherence to autonomy as just the kind of last word is that we don't ever start from a very enriched account of autonomy. That's part of the problem. But B, mm-hmm. then when we do assume that we have, you know, that autonomy is our lodestar, as it were, you know, it means that other ethical obligations and duties to the individual just sort of fall away. And I think we also find this when we think about individuals who are found to have capacity and then they are effectively left to languish in their own situation. And I mean, that has emerged in some of our interview data that we, I mean, it's not related to the book, but it's related to the project that I currently run. It has also emerged, I think there was a submission in one of the reports in the House of Lords post-scrutiny report, where there was a worry about how capacity and the finding capacity means that individuals are basically left to their own devices and they're not provided the supports that they are entitled to and they require in order for them to flourish.
Yeah, and I think that was a really interesting point that, you know, supporting autonomy, just to sort of like oversimplify a bit, but supporting autonomy doesn't necessarily mean this sort of hands-off approach in every case. So then can you tell me a little bit about this concept of absorbed coping? It's not something I was really familiar with, but I found it really interesting.
So I have a long-standing interest in phenomenology, and there's some wonderful work that has been done in this tradition by Dreyfus and Samuel Todd's, and the account of absorbed coping is to really push back on the assumption that valid coping, valid knowing, valid engagement with the world requires kind of cognitive, rational thought. In some ways, it is to reclaim the precognitive space in which we cope and understand and engage with the world, and say that that actually is a valid way of understanding and knowing the world in its own right. Mm-hmm. So when we think about I use this example because I'm a keen gardener, I love gardening. Mm-hmm. And so I was just thinking about, you know, the kind of automatic actions that you do as a gardener that you don't think about them. And you know, when I'm placing a spade in the ground, I don't think that I need to place it in the ground or I need to, mm-hmm. I hit a root and I need to move it. I don't think this. Mm-hmm. Part of my skill as a gardener comes with just knowing and doing these actions automatically. Mm-hmm. And why absorbed coping is so important in the context of impairment, in my view, is because it identifies how alternative ways of knowing and engaging with the world that from the outside might not look like they are engaging in any reflective thought, might in fact reflect very, very knowing and skillful ways of engaging with the world. I use a lot of examples from The Reason I Jump and Naoki Higashida's mm-hmm. work, and it's just his work is wonderful in that regard, to really highlight how the impact of his impairment, but how this manifests itself in a different way of engaging with the world physically, with time, with the kind of phenomenological our phenomenological grounding when we think about space and time, right? And how this his body engages with these aspects, these conditions of experience in an entirely different way. And then I also think about examples of trauma, because if we think about examples of severe trauma and, you know, where you have conditions of, say, unstable emotional dysregulation, right? And there and a lot of self-harming, for example, these are actual coping behaviors.
Yeah.
And it is important to actually acknowledge that these are coping behaviors rather than we might say that they're at the end of the day dysfunctional or harmful to the individual, but you have to actually validate those modes of coping and engaging with the world, because they reflect a way of navigating and negotiating the world in a successful way for the individual and their embodiment and their experience.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading about the book, The Reason I Jump. I'm sorry, I've forgotten how to pronounce the author's name. But yeah, it's just so interesting. I think the protagonist was, he had autism. It was really, really interesting to read about that and how, you know, this concept of absorbed coping actually how it works and applies. So yeah, that was really great. And your sort of example of gardening I found really interesting just now too. I'm a keen runner, and so I feel exactly the same. You know, I don't think about all the motions that I'm going through. You just sort of do, and it is your way of sort of being in the world and existing and coping and reacting.
And the thing is that if you injected thought into it, that would also reflect that you are not as skillful as a runner as you should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's in some respects that kind of those automatic adjustments that we make shows how skillful we are. Mm. And it's not a result of cognitive thought.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that was super interesting. So then I want to talk about, you know, in these sort of examples, how do we avoid, you know, paternalism? Because, you know, people with impairments have encountered this long history of sort of paternal intervention. So how do we try and avoid this in these sort of really difficult cases?
I think a lot depends on the competencies of those who are intervening, really. I mean, and because there might be justification for those interventions. There might be strong ethical and strong legal reasons why there is an intervention. And in some ways that, you know, the argument to set aside, well, not necessarily set aside, but to question this hard and fast private and public distinction is precisely to say that there is scope for legitimate intervention. But how you avoid paternalism is in some ways with your orientation, your interpretive orientation, your own ethical orientation as an intervener. And that's why I feel that the crux of the book is really highlighting the what I call the hermeneutic competencies of assessors, of those who are involved in best interest decision making, because it all comes down to certain skills and competencies of those individuals. And there is not enough emphasis on that, as opposed to just focusing, well, this needs to be done, X needs to be done. But there's not a lot of discussion about, well, how and why, and what kind of, what is my stance and my orientation towards this individual as I am intervening, as I'm assessing.
So maybe can you talk a little bit more and expand upon some of the ethical duties of support and intervention?
So I think that obviously the duties have to be within the appropriate constraints of what is it for, you know, that, mm-hmm. that so the end point has to be in some respects respectful of the individual, you know, so that's the whole idea about intervention has to be one where you're promoting autonomy competencies, not one that where you are just placing them in another situation where they're only going to be cultivate other dependencies, yeah. And not actually be allowed to find their own voice or cultivate their own voice. So that I think that is one aspect that is a major constraint. You know, what is our intervention for? But they also, I think, have to be within a framework of respect insofar as that, you know, individuals are seen as, that they're given some deliberative standing, you know, that they are shown deliberative respect even in that process. So one of the, you know, so for example, individuals who might, we saw this in some of our field work for our, or not our field work, our interviews in the project that I currently run, how important it is for individuals, even if they know that the decision, the final decision is not the one that they wanted, not the one that they favored, and they but if they're shown deliberative respect throughout the process by the various lawyers, by the judge in the end, that they will be far more receptive to that decision because they have been shown some kind of standing throughout that process, which is a very alienating and difficult process. So I think those are, you know, major conditions in which one has to adhere to, you know, that you have to show that individual that they have a certain moral standing in these proceedings.
And then so you identify this sort of catch-22 situation in the recognition of decisional support. And it's almost a little controversial. On one hand, you know, the social model of disabilities emphasizes universal legal capacity by protection of negative liberties and civil rights of people with impairments. But on the other hand, and Tom Shakespeare has also identified this, that even once social barriers to disability have been removed, there may be residual difficulties intrinsic to a person which can affect the extent of a person's disability. Now, the social model doesn't really seem to deal with this point. That at times supporting autonomy may effectively require intervention. You've talked a bit about this, but can you elaborate a bit more on this sort of catch-22 situation?
I think it is controversial, and so I don't want to. I think that the language that I use in the book is already indicative about my position on it in some respects, because. And I don't want to paint all social model of disability theorists the same way, because there are variations and there have been real refinements to in an effort to address Tom Shakespeare's point. Mm-hmm. But I think that part of my issue is to just really highlight how impairment and the kind of biological dimensions, the embodied dimensions, are important to consider and important to take into account. And that we risk neglecting individuals and their needs if we do not actually acknowledge the reality of those effects of one's embodiment. So I use this example about my niece, Ava, for example, who has Rett syndrome, and about how if we did not really recognize and acknowledge that there are certain impairments of her body, and these impairments are not value neutral. The fact that she has trouble swallowing is not a value neutral thing. It has profound implications in her life, and it's not a desirable thing. But it doesn't mean that we define her based on that. Yeah. But it means that in order to treat her properly, to attend to her needs appropriately, we have to always be mindful of how her embodiment can lead to certain limitations, and be mindful of it and be attentive to it. And that's the way that we actually don't define her by her disability, yeah, in some respects, because we recognize that, you know, Ava's far more than her limitations, but we have to see her limitations also as constitutive of who she is in some ways. Mm-hmm. That is part of who she is. We accept who she is, but we have to attend to it and be proactive about it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did really enjoy reading about your niece, Ava. She sounded just so lovely, and it was just a really nice way to sort of make what you write about really real. So now a sort of another argument from another side comes from care theory, and I think Jonathan Herring writes about this. Can you talk a little bit more about care theory and perhaps the merits and any limits that you see?
So, I mean, it is interesting because I did engage with Jonathan Herring's approach rather than the actual care theorists. Mm-hmm. And I think some care theorists might say that I should have engaged more directly with their but I think my choice was partly because I wanted to look at how it's been applied to the law. But my problem, I mean, I think care theory has strengths insofar as it does emphasize neglected dimensions that we might not think is relevant to the law. You know, so the importance of the burden of care, the importance of welfare, you know, the importance of the relational dimensions of care. And these are all very important features. But I think that it's a bit like autonomy. I don't think that anything can be reduced to a single concept, you know, that our duties, our obligations, our way of understanding the complexities in this area of law is not reducible to a single concept. Mm-hmm. The other problem that I think is a slight shortcoming of care theory is that it does tend to be fairly reductive about the female experience, yeah, and saying, because it was seen as a kind of feminist rejoinder by some circles to theories of justice. And I think that kind of lineage makes me slightly uncomfortable, because I don't think that by reclaiming the domestic labor of women and the fact that women are overwhelmingly carers and, you know, have the caring burden, I don't think it redresses some core fundamental issues that we should be focused on in terms of, it just doesn't include issues of justice. It doesn't include, the role of rationality, or, you know, as opposed to care. I think it's just the binary dimension of it, you know, care versus justice or whatnot. Yeah. I think it's just a little bit too reductive for my taste.
Mm. Yeah, and that's really interesting. It definitely gave me a lot to think about, so thank you. I want to turn next to your chapter on hermeneutic competence and the dialogical conditions of capacity. Can you first explain for the audience what hermeneutic competence is?
Very simply, these competencies, and hermeneutic competence captures the competencies that are required for individuals who are the capacity assessor, or who are embedded in those relational conditions to enhance and enable individuals and their decision-making capacity. In some respects, then, we all need to cultivate hermeneutic competence. But what I am trying to articulate here is the specific skills, the specific competencies that are required in acknowledging certain impairments of some kind, and what kinds of skills are required in these conditions.
And then also the go on.
And I should also preface it also is that, I mean, the whole notion of hermeneutics and hermeneutic, it stems from this, again, this Gadamerian notion that we are in an interpretive situation always. You know, we are always, we are always embedded in some kind of interpretive context. And so we can interpret and understand well, and we can equally do this very badly. And so it is trying to articulate how we interpret and understand others well.
Yeah. Yeah, and that makes sense. So then can you talk also about the dialogical conditions of capacity?
So the dialogical conditions of capacity, I think, I mean, it stems again from Gadamer and what I take, how I apply his philosophy, which is to think about about our prejudgments, you know. So with Gadamer, when he talks about dialogue and how we engage in dialogue, he says that our prejudgments, our prejudices effectively come into play. And they and his notion of play is where they also become up for grabs effectively. Yep. That we find ourselves shifting constantly because our prejudices are up for grabs, and we're putting them at risk effectively in these dialogical conditions. So, you know, for example, if I was to think about my niece Ava, you know, if I was thinking about the dialogical conditions, I would say that I might, when I engage with her for the very first time and I have no idea about how to engage with someone who is nonverbal and makes noises to express themselves, my prejudgment, my initial prejudgment is that might be, well, oh, you know, Ava must be very, very stupid, you know, because she cannot use language and she, you know, she doesn't actually have values. But to actually attend and question my prejudgment is to say, well, as I engage with her more and more, and as I open myself more and more to her way of knowing and experiencing the world, the more that my prejudgment, that prejudice is no longer, it might be questioned, it might be, well, actually, my way of understanding the world, my way of understanding her, my way of understanding how people might engage and experience the world has shifted, it's changed through that dialogical engagement with Ava. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. No, it really does. Like, just to sort of sum it up, it's sort of about, I think, questioning one's own prejudgment in making assessments. And
it's also recognizing that you have those, you know, to say that the idea that you do not have those is not a valid assumption in this case. So in some respects, the dialogical conditions of you know, to express that kind of skillful ability to understand and interpret someone, you have to be mindful that I have these prejudgments, I have these assumptions. Sir Mark Headley, in his wonderful book called The Modern Judge, he writes very eloquently about the fact that, you know, as a judge in the welfare jurisdiction, he knows that he has these values, he knows that he has these prejudgments, and in some ways these are they are unavoidable, and they can be unproductive, they can actually be a barrier to understanding somebody, but they also equally can be productive sources of knowledge. And in some respects, being aware of the fact that one has these enables one's prejudgments and prejudices to be productive sources of advancing knowledge and advancing understanding.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And that certainly sounds like it should be compulsory reading for not just people who work in welfare jurisdictions, but I think anyone who aspires to be a lawyer, to recognize that they do have prejudgments and to be aware of these. So then just sort of bringing all your points together, in your final chapter on rethinking capacity, you sort of sum up with some key points. And please correct me. I've tried to sort of very briefly sum up. But so firstly, you argue that autonomy must incorporate phenomenological relational dimensions. Second, you write that the competence of those around individuals with impairments matters. Next, you argue that the content of self-constituting narratives matters. The fourth key point is that the boundary between capacity and best interests is blurry and elastic. And finally, you make the point that capacity as a socially situated, relational and dialogical concept transforms the role of the capacity assessor. Now, I know this is sort of like a very big question and it touches on so many issues, but I'm wondering if you can just sort of draw these key points together.
Gosh, that's a challenge.
It's like, it's basically the whole book. I apologize.
I mean, I think that perhaps, you know, one way to think about it is how this transforms our ideas of capacity in practice as well as conceptually. So I think that one of the key points is that we tend to think about capacity as a cliff edge, right? You have capacity or you don't. But an important feature of taking into consideration the relational conditions of capacity, of also understanding one's own role in facilitating capacity or being a barrier to capacity, means that that boundary is far more fluid and the scope for intervention is a little bit more fluid. But what that means is that the justification for intervention, the justification behind defining a capacity, has to be far more robust and transparent about, and also being reflexive about how one has engaged in that encounter, as it were. How has one interpreted what has been said or expressed, you know, through words, through bodily action, through emotion? How has one tried to understand and engage with the individual? I think effectively, if I was to tie it all together, it just makes capacity, the role of capacity assessment, the findings of capacity assessment, it makes it far more demanding. Yep. The justification, the grounding for it, is far more demanding than we might envisage. And it is also the case, if I was to summarize all of those points, it is to say that there are no simple answers. And that and that's a very, very, you know, it's a typical academic response to practice and, you know, and practical practitioners and judges and et cetera, they will all probably say, well, we, at the end of the day, we have to make a decision. And so it has to be in some ways simplified. Mm-hmm. But I think a large part of this project, about this book, about what I've done subsequently, has been to stress that there is so much nuance and complexity in this area. And we do ourselves a disservice, and we also do a huge disservice to the individuals who are affected by this legislation, by our concepts of mental capacity, etc., when we try to oversimplify the conceptual and normative terrain. And part of recognizing and grappling with that nuance and complexity is to learn to be comfortable with that complexity, learn to be comfortable with that discomfort in some ways, and to think about how am I embedded in my own values and my own, you know, in my own interpretive situation? How do I understand others? And, you know, and that's an ongoing process. It is a skill that requires constant work, and no one, you know, you're just constantly improving on it, but it is always, you are always in different situations that require different skills, adaptiveness. And I think that's really the crux of it. But it is to highlight how demanding that role is. It is not going to lead to simple answers and simple principles.
Yeah, and I think identifying that there are no simple answers and really focusing on the nuances and recognizing them and the complexities does actually move us forward, rather than the sort of knee-jerk reaction to oversimplify, which I think does take place in courts by way of necessity or not. But I do think, yeah, this is all, like, it's really important to recognise. And so now, Camilia, I've taken up a lot of your time, but just before you go, the final and traditional New Books Network question, what are you working on now?
So I have, I think I mentioned in your previous podcast how currently that I'm still leading the Judging Values project, and we are currently doing some very exciting work around training and communication for legal practitioners. We'll hopefully have a video that will be coming out soon that will be open access and everybody can access it if they're interested. But I'm also, you know, really just doing some further work on this, you know, in this area. I think this is an area where you never really stop examining certain questions. And I think, I mean, the biggest one that has that has been interesting me lately has been about how do we understand and attribute intentionality to people with profound communication barriers, and how, you know, how do we understand that those conditions and validate expressions effectively of people who really struggle to communicate. So I'd like to do some further work on that, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, no, it sounds really interesting. And I mean, anyone listening, I would definitely recommend both of Camilia's books that I've read. The first on a previous podcast was on the Mental Capacity Act in 2005. And what I loved about that is it takes all these really complex theories and it applies them in practice. So yeah, it really sounds like the work you're doing now will be really, really relevant. But of course, today we've been talking about Camilia Kong's other book, Mental Capacity in Relationship, Decision-Making, Dialogue and Autonomy. It was published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. Camilia Kong, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.